You are listening to the Mindset Forge podcast, where athletes and performing artists discuss their biggest moments and mindset shifts that help make them so successful. High-level athletes and performing artists understand how to show up for the big moments, how to be present and on point when everything counts. That's what I want to find out about, and that's what I want to help understand so that we can take some of those amazing nuggets and implement them in our own lives. And I'm your host, Barton Bryan. I'm an athlete, I'm a fitness coach, and I'm a former actor and singer. And I love helping people rise to their fullest potential. That's why I'm doing this podcast. This is my first episode with a performing artist. I get to interview Adam Flowers. He's actually an old friend of mine. We grew up together, and he's a professional opera singer. And that right there, for some of you, are like, whoa, opera, I'm out. But trust me, take a minute and listen. First of all, he's got a great backstory, and he's just a really humble guy talking about singing opera. He's a tenor, so he's singing those big roles that you would think of Pavarotti, Domingo, those guys, the three tenors concert, all that kind of stuff. He actually talks about that. But he's also an athlete. We played basketball together. He was a baseball player in high school, and he understands the analogy between sports, especially team sports, and performance. And then he goes into a lot of mindset strategies around showing up big for performance. What do you do when everything kind of goes wrong? Coming from outside of the fitness industry, we talk about his mindset, how he approaches things, and what he's understood in his life because of his professional opera career. I'm going to piece together this interview with a little bit more commentary from me so I can keep you on track. And in the show notes, we'll have a couple of links where you can see a YouTube video of him singing opera, because you're going to fall in love with this guy. You're going to want to hear him. You're going to see more from this guy. And so I want to help you do that. All right, buckle up. Here we go. My friend, Adam Flowers. Adam, how are you today?
I'm doing well. It is good to see you, my friend.
Let's start with you as a singer. Obviously, current pandemic situation over the last 12, 13 months has really brought the theater and opera world to a halt. What has that been like for you, and how have you made the most of it?
To be obvious, it's an incredible challenge. I was set in April of 2020 to go to Hawaii Opera Theater and perform in a production of Salome by Strauss. There was really looking forward to it. Hadn't sung at Hawaii Opera Theater in a while. And then obviously middle of March came and that all shut down. And that was a disappointment. I think just emotionally, the thing that made it a little easier was it wasn't a matter of, well, I can't do it, but it's still going to happen. Because there was, this isn't happening for anybody, there was a strange kind of psychological relief for that, because it meant it wasn't just me being left out. But in terms professionally and monetarily, it stunk.
Let's go back to growing up Davis, California, which is not too far from your, where you live now, and talk about the time in which you discovered singing for yourself. And because I think there's an interesting journey for you that a lot of people, like, you know, grew up in the choir or just always were singing from a very early age. You're somebody who kind of found singing a little bit later. Why don't you tell that story, kind of how that came about?
Well, first and foremost, as you know, and our listeners might not know, Davis is an extremely unique place. It was a pretty incredible place to grow up. It's not a perfect place by any stretch of the imagination, but it was really, everyone from Davis kind of has that look in their eye when they see each other, like, Davis, there's just, you had to be there. There's just kind of this sense of that. And I was lucky. I grew up in a household. My parents weren't musicians, but they were music lovers, especially my father. I would raid his LP collection and later CD collection all the time. And he had a real broad range of musical interests. And I had a lot of friends who were really into music, and not just what was on FM 102. To the pop station in Sacramento, but all different kinds of fun music, yourself included. You were the one who got me into The Who, who got me really into Paul Simon. I mean, not that those were totally obscure, but I hadn't really listened to much of either of those before I met you. And I could list a bunch of other friends as examples for other types of music. But I loved music and never saw myself as a musician. And then soccer's World Cup happened in 1990. And I'm not a soccer player. So what does that have to do with anything? Well, it was in Italy. And so Italy was showcasing all of its the cream of its cultural crop. And one of those things was the three tenors concert. And I had heard opera and classical music, and my dad had a bunch of classical music LPs, so it wasn't foreign to me. But I saw the Three Tenors concert on PBS, and that blew my doors off. But even more so, specifically when the movie Untouchables came out, and I invited a bunch of friends, we watched the Untouchables on VHS, and it came to the scene where Robert De Niro as Al Capone is at the opera. And it goes back and forth between him at the opera and Sean Connery being murdered in his apartment. And it's a very dramatic moment. And the opera that Capone is watching is Pagliacci by Leoncavallo. And it's the very famous aria, Vesti la Giubba, with the clown who's putting on his makeup. And I'm laughing on the outside, but I'm crying on the inside. It's very dramatic, incredible music. And that blew my mind. It just blew my mind, and I had this palpable sensation that my life had changed. I'm being dead serious. There was something about that music that I felt like that was a marker point of my life before and after, and I had this very real sense that I was different. Like, I mean, not different from everyone else, but that I had changed.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even the whole aria. It was just the last part of it. So
what's great is somebody else would have had that same experience and become a gangster because of that movie. Yeah. But you're like, well, I'm an opera singer. That's what I need to do.
Well, you know, if it had been earlier in the movie when Al Capone had the baseball bat, I would have become a baseball player. So those two things, it was weird because it just that happened with the Untouchables. And then the World Cup was maybe a month or two later. It was just in the air for me anyway. And I started noticing it where I hadn't before. And so I asked my mom, I said, Mom, you know that opera about the clown? She's like, yeah, Pagliacci. I really like that. How do I get something that's like that, like an album? So she bought me a $3.99 cassette. Laser Light Records, the greatest hits of Plácido Domingo. It wasn't even like studio recordings. Basically, somebody had made all these bootlegs of him in Europe when he was like in his 30s. And then that's why it was only $3.99, right? And so I would just listen to that over and over again and sing along to it. And at this point, I was like a sophomore in high school. And our friend Mike Monagle heard me kind of jokingly imitating an opera singer. And he's, oh, you have to audition for jazz choir. And I can't sing. I'm not a singer. It's like, you just were singing. I'm like, no, that was me doing my impression of a singer. And he said, well, just come and do an impression of a singer for your audition. He kept bugging me and I kept saying no. And then one day he comes up to me and he just says, Adam, well, I won't say her name because that might be, but so-and-so cute girl, she's also in jazz choir. Oh. And he's like, do you know what the big guys do in jazz choir? They lift the girls for the dance things. Oh. And so I finally thought, you know what? I'll audition. I won't get in, but Mike won't be able to bug me anymore. So I was singing it as kind of like a vaccine against Mike asking me. I'll get inoculated by humiliating myself. So I auditioned and got in. And then I was like, oh, crap. I guess I have to do this. But I was excited because I loved music. I just never thought of myself as a musician, especially not then. And, you know, I hear people talk a lot about imposter syndrome, which, I mean, I basically think anyone who's not an imposter feels that. I think the only people who don't feel imposter syndrome are imposters. But I didn't even have imposter syndrome because even when I was doing it, I would have the distinct feeling that it's not that I'm an imposter. It's not even real. So it was very strange. But I think in a weird way, it gave me kind of a freedom to express myself because I wasn't trying to get on the next rung of whatever the imaginary ladder is, because I didn't even think I was on the ladder. And what I didn't realize is that was going to end up being the key to any kind of success I had. And I don't want anyone to mistake that for not trying, not working hard, but because I always felt like I was kind of working at a deficit. And I don't mean deficit of talent necessarily, but just I started late. I can't read music. When I did my first opera, I could barely read music. I was learning how to read music while I was getting my first working jobs. It wasn't imposter syndrome. I'm just a dude. And because I was focusing on this gig, because a lot of times I kind of had the feeling I was hanging on by my fingertips, I couldn't think about goals because I was so focused on the moment. And that ended up being an incredible asset, especially for something like performing.
This comment from Adam reminds me of something I heard in the Peace Corps. You have 1 foot in the past, you got 1 foot in the future, and you're pissing all over the present. It's a bit crass, but it highlights the point. He's barely able to be in the room with these other musicians because he started late. He had to focus on this job, this moment, not his career, not what could happen, but this moment. And I think that's the magic. And what he's talking about is we got to remember that part of showing up is showing up completely in the moment.
So many of the benchmarks are completely subjective, very unlike lifting weights or trying to achieve a certain amount of reps with Yeah, you get through the piece, you don't get through the piece, but so much of the artistic aspect is extremely amorphous, and you really have to get out of your own way to be able to present something artistic that people find compelling. It's one thing to present a very impressive technical display, which is important, but if you can't layer on top of that the X factor, the artfulness, then you have people going, wow, that's extremely impressive technically. They're not being swept away and taken away. And I feel like I was able to get experience doing the thing that most people have to kind of back end. I was getting my education in total reverse. I had the advantage with some of the amorphous stuff initially, but then I was having to learn fundamentals like how to breathe as opposed to the other way around. So it was a very unconventional way to go about it, but I wasn't doing it on purpose. It just kind of was happening to me that way. So I was responding.
I'm about to play an excerpt from the rehearsal where Adam sings Que Jalida Manina from La Boheme, the tenor aria, and it goes right into the high C. And in the opera world, high C's are awesome. Kind of like Michael Jordan jumping from the free throw line and dunking. When it's done well, it brings the house down. So here's Adam bringing the house down with his high C.
Conundrum of opera specifically, or any kind of theatrical musical performance where it's music layered on drama, is if I was just doing a concert or a vocal competition, I would still need to tell a story with my art, but it would be in snippets and chunks, and the technical part would be much more on display. But the thing is about a full performance, the technical stuff does have to be there. And it has to be exceptional. It's not that the drama is more important. It's that they're both critically important. But you have to be so technically secure and proficient that you can then forget about that. It's really weird.
And we see the same concept in any high-level performance. Think about acrobats, actors, dancers. People want to see an actor or a performer put their heart and soul into something. They don't just want to see something technically good. They want to be swept away. And I think that's important to understand in whatever we're doing. Now, if we're just running a 100-meter dash, bravado is not going to necessarily be important. But you know, on some level, it is. Think about Usain Bolt. That man oozed bravado. From the moment he got on the starting blocks to the moment he blasted through the finish line, breaking the world record and running around, pointing out in the audience, flexing and just getting everyone fired up like they just saw the most incredible thing they'll ever see in their life. Performance. And that's exactly what Adam's talking about.
There's a group of us opera singers that have this like group chat that we're all San Francisco Giants fans. And the analogies between artistic performance and sports performance, I mean, they really go hand in hand because those guys are not thinking about the mechanics of their throwing arm while they're throwing. They've spent that time thinking about their mechanics when they practice at spring training in the off season, so that when they play, they not only don't have to, but they kind of can't. Your brain can't think about those things. When I'm singing something from a passage from an opera, the last thing I can think about is what the musculature in my throat is doing. But before that opera starts, I have to spend a tremendous amount of time thinking about what that musculature is doing. And where the analogy with sports breaks down is that art is the least competitive thing I can possibly imagine. I mean, we have art as a business and a profession, so there's competition around it, but the act itself is fundamentally non-competitive. A game is a performance too, because you might say that the Warriors, they're the cast of an opera. The problem is they're performing against another opera. And so that's where it's weird, because nothing happens in the context of a performance where you're trying to throw anyone off their game. That's death. That's instant death. It would be like you have a weightlifting partner and you're trying to trick them while they're lifting. I mean, it's unthinkable, right? So it's, but there are a lot of analogies with sports. I mean, the word performance, it's right there. You can't get around it.
One of the things about live performance is like, you know, I need to be at this spot to sing this song. Then I walk over here, I interact with this actor or singer. So it's all staged, right? There's beats and moments that are already built in. And then you have to figure out how to make that fluid and feel improvisational, even though it's all scripted and it's all been worked out.
Correct. And in a weird way, now that I think about, you've got me on basketball, especially like running plays. I mean, it's easy for us to forget how scripted the action on a basketball court is. You and I know because we had to memorize those plays. And when we watch a Warriors game, it just looks like they're buzzing around. But we know that's extremely scripted. And you might think, well, but the problem is, you know, in an opera, there's nothing that's going to prevent you from carrying out that play, as opposed to the Lakers, who are trying to prevent the Warriors' plays from happening constantly. But the similarity actually is that I have to assume that it's going to go haywire at any second. So that means I'm prepared to make it work when my colleagues, either for whatever reason, things go haywire, because I don't want the audience to realize it goes haywire. And so it's my job to never be responsible for making the audience think, even if I don't make the initial mistake, if I'm the one that doesn't help fix it, that's my fault. The thing that really makes me love performing is how high stakes it is in the moment, but how low stakes it is in the context of life. So if I make a mistake in an opera, it doesn't hurt anybody. Everything's fine. It may have ramifications professionally, artistically. It may have ramifications for my nerves in the moment. But it's this incredible way to like bungee jump without endangering yourself, because the moment to moment emotional stakes feel just as intense as jumping out of a plane, but it's so much safer than jumping out of a plane. And for me, I love that act of collaboration, and I love that knowing at any moment it might go completely haywire and we're all going to have to bring it back on track. That is just it's the best feeling. It's so great.
So stay with the mindset there. Talk about the preparation it takes. If it's opening night, 8 o'clock show, what are you doing that day? Rituals, habits, things that are getting you mentally, physically ready for that moment.
Definitely starts the day before. You do as much as you can of your normal routine that won't impact your physical readiness, won't impact your voice. You don't go to the baseball game the day before the performance and scream your head off. You remove yourself from situations where you know you'll be tempted to, either drink to excess but you also learn you can't be a monk, because that can also kind of shut you down. So you have to guard yourself against things that will unintentionally sabotage you, but you also can't just lay on the couch. The night before, you get a good night's sleep. You go to bed a little earlier. Whatever you need to do to make that happen, if it's a late workout, whatever. The next day, you wake up as late as your schedule and body will allow. I mean, generally, the day of a performance, you don't have any early morning obligations connected to the performance. You move as much as you can during the day. Don't do any hardcore workouts. Do a nice, brisk, modified workout. Don't be sedentary. And then as you approach, you eat earlier than normal. I'm not going to eat after 4:30. That's just me. And then you go to the performance. You really try not to psych yourself up, but you stay kind of in a nice, healthy headspace of, all right, I'm ready. You go over scenes in your head. You visualize them. You sing through passages by audiating, which means you're just hearing it in your head. You're not moving your mouth. You're not making a sound. You're just singing through it in your head. You're thinking about where you are when you sing. And then for me, I would just do the minimum amount of vocalizing. The whole concept of how to warm up your voice is completely unique to each individual person. I knew a guy who would practically sing through the whole role in the dressing room, which is great. If that helped him, that's great. I would do no more than 5 minutes of vocal warm-up at the theater. And then you really try to focus on your character. You get yourself in a headspace of enjoying make-believe. I got to play all these characters. A lot of them were nothing like me. And I would enjoy that. You know, I would enjoy getting to be a murderer. It's fun because it's pretend. It's not real.
We don't often realize how fragile a performance can be and how important it is to have a plan. Hey, I want to show up at the gym at my best. I want to go do a long run tonight and I want to be at my best. I'm thinking about hydrating. I'm thinking about getting a good night's sleep the night before. I'm thinking about all the little things that are going to put my headspace and my body at a place that I can get the most out of the moment and I can put the most into the workout or the lift or whatever I'm doing. Adam's talking about getting prepared to sing an opera, and he understands that there's so much more than just showing up at the theater an hour before and buzzing his lips together to get his voice warmed up. I want to talk about teachers. Who's been really the biggest impact in your life, and what if you feel like you've gotten from that teacher and that's shaped you probably more than others?
Well, I've had a lot of great teachers in and out of music. I can think of my journalism advisor at San Jose State before I switched to music, who, when I asked him, he had heard me perform for the first time. And then I came to him a couple weeks later and I said, I've been offered a scholarship if I switch from journalism to voice. What should I do? And he just looked at me and he said, if I could sing, do you think I'd be writing for magazines? So there's people like that who I'm grateful for. But there's really two people who are mostly responsible for me even being anywhere near music. The first is our dear late departed music teacher at Davis High School, Richard Brunel. He was a great guy. Everybody who knew him and saw Mr. Holland's Opus, like, wow, it's like Mr. Holland's Opus, except Mr. Brunel was nicer and better. He was just an incredible talent. He did not need to be a high school music teacher. He could have been a lot of other things in music, but he chose that. And he was the first person who made me feel like I was a musician. Like I was an artist. I never, ever thought of myself in those terms at all. And it wasn't like, oh, I wish I could be an artist, or I wish I could be like I was a musician. Those weren't even wishes I thought I could have. And he was the first person that made me feel like that's something I could do. And I'll always be grateful to him. He wanted me to do a short little solo in a song from Cats by Andrew Lloyd Webber. And it wasn't the whole song. It was just this introductory thing where I was going to sing by myself. And I'd never done that before. And I told him, Mr. Brunel, I don't feel comfortable doing that. And he pulled me aside and he said, does this lose glasses? Adam, sorry, for those of you in podcast land, I just did a cute thing with my non-existent glasses. Adam, the lowest grade anyone's ever gotten in the Davis High School Jazz Choir is a B+. If you don't sing this solo, you will get an F. And I thought, okay. And he said, let me ask you this. Why don't you want to sing the solo? And I said, well, because it's not what I do. It's not who I am. And he said, yes, it is. You don't have a choice. And as soon as he said that, I realized that I really didn't have a choice. And another person we both know, Steve Walter, fellow classmate, would always say, it is our fate to create, kind of as a joke. He was kind of, you know, making fun of artsy types, but he's also kind of serious. And he was right. And I realized then that it was my fate to create. So Richard Brunel. And then the other person is a woman named Irene Dallas. She passed away in 2014. But Irene Dallas grew up in San Jose, was born in the late 20s, and became a world-renowned mezzo-soprano in the opera world, sang at the Met, is on more Met broadcasts than even Callas or anyone else, or Pavarotti or Domingo. an incredible performer. And all she wanted to do was come back when she retired to her hometown and start an opera company. So she started an opera workshop at San Jose State and then founded Opera San Jose. And I auditioned for Opera Workshop when I was still a journalism major. And I was a double major in non-performance music because I wanted to be a musical journalist. So I auditioned for Opera Workshop. And of course, I sang Vesti la Giubba, the aria from The Untouchables, because I had no idea that it was so difficult. And because I didn't know it was difficult, I could do it. And so I just did it. And she said, "Who are you?" And I said, "Well, I'm Adam Flowers." She said, "Well, I know that, but what is your major?" And I said, "Well, I'm a journalism major." And she said, "No, it's not. You're a music major." And I was about to say, "No, I'm not." And then, of course, the grinding gears of Adam's tiny brain was like, "Oh, I think I know what she means." And subsequently, she offered me a scholarship if I switched majors. She started giving me really big opportunities in the opera workshop at San Jose State. And then almost as quickly as she could, started hiring me for small roles at Opera San Jose. And she was a very difficult woman. She wasn't a bad person, but she was very old school. She was your boss when it suited her, and she was your grandmother when it suited her. All of that being said, she, like Mr. Brunel, made me feel like I belonged. And she pushed me. She gave me opportunities. People told her, "You shouldn't let him do that. He's not ready." And she would say, "I know he's not ready. I want to see what he does." People don't do that anymore, Barton. They don't take those risks on people. Because her only goal with the opera company was to keep it functioning. She wasn't trying to make money off of it. And so for her, it was this dream laboratory where she could just help people get better at their craft. And so she would have me do things she knew I wasn't ready for just to see what I would do. And 99 times out of 100, I figured out a way to make it work. And it was a completely unique opportunity. That type of learning for opera, it simply doesn't exist anymore. And she was kind of the last of its kind even then. And now that paradigm is gone. She was an incredible woman.
They threw things at you because on some level, they probably realized that you were up for the challenge.
Well, and you know, it's interesting you say that now, because I'd never really thought of it in these terms, but that quality of me, I had always thought of as kind of either a recklessness or kind of a dumbassishness, like a doofishness. I'm saying that poorly on purpose.
We are not cutting that. That's in this podcast.
No, it is. But I had always thought of that as kind of like I don't really know what I'm doing. And I think she called my BS, and it's like, no, you can't hide behind that. You can't hide behind that because that's not the case. You're trying to play dumb. And I actually wasn't trying to play dumb, but I'll fully admit, you might be able to relate as a fellow big guy. There are people now as adults who are a lot bigger than us. But when we were in junior high, we were the bigger kids. And a really effective way to deal with being a big kid was to be totally willing to kind of make fun of yourself and to diminish yourself. And I never thought of myself as doing that. Like, it was never really something I consciously did. But in hindsight, I did a lot of that. And so I think there was that element of not so much selling myself short, but attributing certain positive attributes I had as kind of benign weaknesses. I don't know if that makes sense, but I think I did a lot of that. And she simply refused to allow me to do it.
Talk to us about a specific moment where you had to figure it out, stay in the moment.
I thought about mine, and I've been lucky. I haven't had too many that were complete catastrophes, but I can think of two. One was in a performance of Faust in San Jose. My character Faust was hiding behind a hedgerow. And of course, these are not real hedges. They're plastic hedges. And as I'm getting ready to make my entrance for the scene that's kind of the most challenging for Faust, I go to take my first breath in for my first singing of that act, and I inhale a dust bunny like fully into my throat that lands square on my larynx. So for those of you who don't know about singing, you probably know, wow, that's probably bad. I go from big picture thinking immediately to extremely moment to moment thinking. So when stuff like that happens, you have to shift you do have to start thinking about technique and training and preparation, because then you're in survival mode. So you have to start figuring out as you're singing, how much pressure can I put on my chords? How deep of a breath can I take without coughing? Can I let her rip on this next passage? Can I do the physicality I was planning on doing? Because will that impact my diaphragm? Like, you have to start thinking about all those things, but you have to do it in a way where it's not obvious you're doing that. So it does change your performance. But when you don't have a technique and you're not prepared, you have to stop. Continuing is not even an option. So the simple fact that I could continue in some fashion was because I was prepared and I had a technique. So I go from thinking about artistry to my next really difficult part is the end of my aria. So I have to, unfortunately, focus on singing the high C at the end of the aria, which is coming in 5 minutes. When things are going smoothly, your preparation is there, but you're not thinking about that. But when things start happening and going wrong, you have to start thinking clinically. So you think clinically about the technical demands, and you tell yourself, get through with a minimal amount of distress and tell the story as best as you can, and that will be good. That will be a triumph. So I got through it. The high C wasn't as long. It wasn't as shimmery, but it was a high C, and I held it for an acceptable amount of time, and I got off stage, and I was able to chug water, and it was fine. But it was harrowing in the moment, because I was completely pulled out of the performance, which normally doesn't happen, even when things go a little wonky. Yeah.
Your equivalent of Michael Jordan's flu game, where he had the flu.
That's what it felt like.
Scored like 40 points. Yeah.
That's what it felt like.
That's your Michael Jordan flu game.
But I scored 15. I scored 15 points.
He could never hit high C. He could never hit high C. Let's just be clear on that.
Especially with those cigars, right?
Looking at the mindset of that too, you're out there just trying to survive in these, you know, moments of like laryngeal drama, and you know, the larynx is on fire with the dust bunny or whatever you got. And we don't stop. We can't.
No.
We can't show the audience. Part of the DNA of a performer is you can't show them your cards. Like, you just got to go out there and do it, even if it doesn't feel right or there's something in your throat, or you just got to do your best.
I had to sing a whole performance once with bronchitis. Now, this is different than the thing before, because it was one of those situations where I didn't have a cover. If I had had a cover, I wouldn't have gone on. But they basically just had to say, Mr. Flowers is vocally indisposed, but has graciously consented, basically because there was no one else to do it. So I sang a lot of the stuff in falsetto. I sang a lot of the stuff down an octave. And what's weird is you'll see a lot of high-flying performers where they're feeling a little off, and they'll do that disclaimer. And then they end up sounding like a god because they've got the get out of jail free card. Like, right. If they take a risk and crack, people are like, oh no, but still they were sick, but they never crack when that get out of jail free card is given, because then they just let it rip.
Right. There's no pressure. Expectations lowered.
100%.
Taking the final step away from mindset around performance, Adam's going to share a story about a friend's advice and how it truly changed his life. So we'll end it here with Adam's story about his friend, Craig.
I had a very good friend. Well, I still have him. He's still alive. He's still with us. An incredible composer and musician named Craig Baumler. And he would coach me for roles I was doing. And one day we were working on a piece, and he just stopped and he looked at me and he said, Adam, have you ever considered what your life would be like if you succeeded beyond your wildest dreams? And I said, no. I'd focused a lot on what my life would be like if I failed, but I'd never actually thought about like what it would mean in practical terms for me if I succeeded. Like if I started getting work like Pavarotti, what that would mean for my life. And so I started thinking about that, and I started realizing that so many of the decisions I was making was not taking that into consideration. So then I started thinking, well, how do I do what I'm doing and get the life, or as close to the life I actually want? And that completely changed almost every decision I made professionally because I realized I knew a lot of people who were succeeding. I'm doing air quotes beyond their wildest dreams, and their life was not something I wanted to have. So then I had to start thinking, what is my personal success? Once I kind of thought about that, then I was able to really start living my own personal journey as a performer and musician. And I started to get the kind of work I really wanted to get.
Adam, just, he's an incredible guy. He is an incredible singer and a very humble guy because he has one of those voices that comes around just once in a lifetime. And I think people heard it when he heard him sing back in high school and they're like, wow, this guy has something special. And I don't think he truly understood it. His teachers understood it. So remember, in the show notes, some links you can click on, hear some of Adam singing, maybe watch a video. For more information, you go to adamflowerstenor.com. That's also a link in the show notes. Don't forget to share the podcast if this really spoke to you. And thanks again for listening to the Mindset Forge podcast.